There's a saying that we find ourselves using on a number of occasions. The saying goes like this: that was your first mistake. Now, if I were to start my comments to you this morning by referring to something I heard on Sunday morning television, I'm afraid you'd be tempted to use that phrase, "Well, Sunday morning television, that was your first mistake." Now, trust me, friends, I am not now going to spout a number of Osteen-isms. But you have to admit, there was something about Jimmy Swaggart, wasn't there? All I want to refer to in reference to Sunday morning television, my friends, is something that we've probably heard in other contexts as well, and that is this strange, frankly, uniquely American habit among some of our Christian brothers and sisters to refer to prophecy, and especially referring to being a prophet, as some kind of privilege, a badge of honor, and thus something to actually aspire to. Self-described prophets. Now, even the most casual attention to the actual words of the Old Testament, my brothers and sisters, would clearly divest even the most gullible of Sunday morning TV viewers to dismiss such an aspiration as not merely silly, but positive insanity. All the more reason, then, isn't it, to take note of the fact that Quakerism itself, on occasion, was called prophetic Christianity revived. You see, we are among those minority groups of Christians that are clearly committed to the frankly rather dangerous notion that prophets still exist. Now, that has resulted in some rather interesting experiences that I'd like to share with you in terms of being a part of a body whose explicit witness is that prophecy still exists. For example, I've taken undergraduates and now some graduate students to New Zealand for nearly 17 years now, and we've developed a very warm relationship there with a group of Māori who are Anglican, including now their new Anglican bishop. The Māori, of course, are the indigenous people of New Zealand. And here's the interesting part of this. After their conversion to Christianity in significantly large percentages in the 19th century, one really interesting part of this mass conversion of the Māori to Christianity was the rise among the Māori of prophets. Prophets modeled on the Old Testament prophets that they were learning from. Now, what's interesting, of course, here is that some of these prophets founded movements that were pan-tribal. That was unprecedented among the Māori in New Zealand, to cross tribal lines. And yet, some of these prophets gathered disciples from literally all over New Zealand. Unprecedented. Some of those prophetic movements still exist today. We would call them a denomination. Now, what's interesting here is the somewhat delighted surprise that I've had among the Māori who talk to us about these prophetic movements, and to have this American professor acknowledge that, yes, they were prophets. You see, they're not used to anyone acknowledging that. They're used to people saying, well, yes, they were interesting leaders, but not to acknowledge them as prophets. Well, this is a part of our heritage, friends. When early Quaker missionaries met the Seneca Nation in upstate New York, it wasn't long before that time that the Seneca people had experienced a movement among themselves led by a prophet named Handsome Lake. And as the Quakers heard the message of Handsome Lake being recounted to them, those early Quakers were able to say, "You have had a prophet in your midst." And they were able to readily acknowledge that. Well, let's not only dwell on the positive aspects of being a people who acknowledge the continued reality of prophecy. And having said this, my friends, we quickly confront a dangerous and a treacherous road ahead. Let me remind you of some of those dangers. To be a prophet in the time of ancient Israel was quite simply to be called to be abused. Ezekiel suffered, it's now usually concluded after a number of books trying to diagnose his psychoses, it seems that Ezekiel clearly suffered from some kind of form of post-traumatic stress. Amos faced expulsion from his homeland. Micah was nearly overcome with his anger toward the central political authorities of his time. A problem, however, that in these days, I must admit, rather endears us to Micah. Prophet Hoshea was ordered to engage in what we would today consider a most unhealthy and unwise love life. Isaiah was told to strip naked to protest an ill-conceived royal strategy. But perhaps it was Jeremiah who most powerfully expresses to us the cry from the heart of being called a prophet. In the last of five passages in the book of Jeremiah that we today know as the Confessions of Jeremiah, five very interesting passages. The last one is perhaps the most filled with pathos. It is in that last one that we read the following. And I'm reading from Jeremiah 20, and I'm going to start where the poetic passage begins. "You have seduced me, Yahweh, and I have let myself be seduced. You have overpowered me. You were the stronger. I am a laughingstock all day long. They all make fun of me. For whenever I speak, I have to howl and proclaim violence and ruin. For me, Yahweh's word has become the cause of insult and derision all day long. I would say to myself, I won't think about him. I won't speak in his name anymore. But then there seemed to be a fire burning in my heart, imprisoned in my bones. The effort to restrain it wearied me. I could not do it. I heard so many disparaging me, terror on every side. Denounce him! Let us denounce him! All those who were on good terms with me watched for my downfall. Perhaps he will be seduced into error. Then we shall get the better of him and take our revenge." Now at this point, there's a kind of pause in the passage. And then it continues in verse 14 on the same theme. "A curse on the day when I was born. May the day my mother bore me be unblessed. A curse on the man who brought my father the news. A son, a boy is born to you, making him overjoyed. May this man be like the towns that Yahweh overthrew without mercy. May he hear the warning cry at dawn and the shout of battle at high noon for not killing me in the womb. My mother would have been my grave and her womb pregnant forever. Why ever did I come out of the womb to see toil and sorrow and end my days in shame? Oh, my friends, we may wish to try and be polite and offer our comforting words, worthy of Job's comforters. But think of your service to the Lord, Jeremiah. Oh, what a powerfully deep spiritual life you must have with the Lord, Jeremiah. Just think of the royalties alone, Jeremiah. Cold comfort, my friends, for a prophet who was finally kidnapped and dragged by his enemies to Egypt, where he died. So, my friends, it would seem from the text that detention is part of the curriculum in a school for prophets. Oh, we know many of the reasons for their suffering, of course. In his public debate with the one that we now call a false prophet, namely Hananiah, the prophet Jeremiah offered only this basis upon which to decide which was the true prophet and which was the false prophet. You know, it's interesting how many times questions will come from my undergraduates: how do you tell a true prophet from a false prophet? And I usually tell them, wait till we get to Jeremiah. And we go to this debate. It was a famous debate. The king of the time was trying to decide, which way shall I go? Do I revolt against the Babylonians that reign over us now? Do I side with the Egyptians? Unfortunately for the king, he had lobbyists in his courtroom. And the two lobbies each had a prophet. The pro-Egypt lobby had their prophet Hananiah. The lobby that rather unfortunately said, stay put, serve the Babylonians, had only our already abused prophet Jeremiah. Hananiah got up and proclaimed God's assistance to us. If we will only revolt, God will be on our side and we will be victorious. You can hear the crowds cheering to this day. Jeremiah stood and said to Hananiah, wouldn't it be nice if that were true? And then he said this to him, listen carefully to this word that I am going to say to you, Hananiah, and to all the people. From remote times, the prophets who preceded you and me prophesied war, disaster, and plague for many countries and great kingdoms. But the prophet who prophesies shalom, peace or well-being, good times, the prophet who prophesies shalom will be recognized as one truly sent by God only when that word comes true. The point is painfully clear. Beware the prophet who tells you what you want to hear. The danger is, of course, that we often do no such thing. Micah bitterly complained about the prophets who could always be depended on to be encouraging and optimistic as long as they were paid. Amos famously denied that he even was a prophet, for fear that he would be associated with those ancient sycophants who preached only good news to those in power. In one wondrous episode, the Judean king Jehoshaphat listened to a variety of supposed prophets tell him how wondrously successful he was going to be. Their number finally included their curmudgeonly prophet Micaiah ben Imlah. And at first he mumbled the same, yes, yes, your highness, everything's going to be wonderful. And then the king turns to Micaiah ben Imlah and says, tell me the truth. At which point, the king received rather seriously bad news. Micaiah is then faced with a torrent of criticism as one of the officials with the king slaps him across the face. And he says, "See, I told you, he's a troublemaker." No doubt he faced outrageous calls to remove him from prophetic recognition by the equivalent of the day of Fox News. The point here is that kings in the Bible, much less contemporary leaders, are not generally noted for piercing courage in demanding the truth from prophets. So we are duly impressed with moments like this. But the larger point remains, my friends. The truth was typically difficult. The truth was typically hard. More often than not, it had to do with seriously bad news. And the worst news was, God was actually attentive to the mistreatment of the most vulnerable in Israelite society, represented by the widow, the orphan, and the foreigner. Not for the Old Testament prophets, my brothers and sisters, was our modern insanity in this country of blaming the poor for all of their misfortune, or reducing any or all kind of assistance, incidentally, that Moses and Jesus demand of us, reducing this assistance, or worse, abusing foreigners merely because they have come here for a better life. The same reason all of our ancestors came here. Now, my brothers and sisters of my home family, this congregation has nurtured and taught and cared for me quite literally since my birth 63 years ago. Please understand that my response to the well-meaning encouragement given to me over the years, and that encouragement has sometimes suggested, "Well, Daniel, perhaps you're a prophet." You'll understand why my response now is quick and immediate. No, thank you. I will happily go back to the library and the classroom, where I only occasionally face the wrath of university administrators who, despite what they may occasionally be tempted to believe, are most certainly not equivalent to the wrath of God. I will happily and with clear relief quote Brother Amos, "I am no prophet, nor a prophet's son." My beloved late father was many wonderful things: a deeply committed Christian, a compassionate man, but prophet, thank God, was not among his attributes. My brothers and sisters, to turn to the main point that I wish to share with you this morning, I have certainly met prophets. I most certainly have met and befriended some rather striking examples of those fiery men and women who were clearly destined in the scriptures to be called Navi. Prophet. My central point is this, my brothers and sisters. I have seen them in this place. Reedwood Friends, my brothers and sisters, has on many occasions served as a school for prophets. And this, like the call to prophecy itself, is a hard road, and don't we know it? You see, many of us have come to understand that prophecy can sometimes be a very early calling. Jeremiah claimed that he was doomed. Doomed to be a prophet, he said, before he was even born. And he clearly considered that a bit unfair. I was once asked to speak to a group of young Roman Catholic seminarians out at the seminary in Camarillo, north of Los Angeles. This is the diocesan seminary for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, which now is the largest Catholic diocese in the country. They asked me to speak about prophecy. That brings up that saying at the beginning, that was your first mistake. But in any case, when I began to share some of the more uncomfortable elements about biblical prophecy, it wasn't long before one of the brave young priests in training raised his hand and he said, "Daniel, can a priest be a prophet?" I thought about it for a moment, briefly considered my professional career at LMU, and I thought about that sincere question and I responded, "I don't think it's the same calling, my brother." The serious point is this, my friends. I have come to suspect that in some cases, our children can quite simply be a pain in the neck, acting with typical adolescent stupidity to which we try to respond with loving support, if not private irritation, and not a few prayers for patience. What I'm beginning to wonder, however, my friends, is whether it is the case that some young people over the decades have actually struggled with an inward fire that they simply were not equipped to understand. And this was largely because they were in the presence of churches that most definitely had no capacity whatsoever to recognize a call to prophecy. There is adolescent rejection of wisdom and reason. There is sheer resentment of advice offered in even the most loving sense. Yes, of course, this is all true. We know this. But there can be something else. There can be a holy fire. There can be a sacred burning. And rare is the congregation equipped with the depth of wisdom to carefully discern that mixed into that adolescent struggle is something else. I know it's rare. I know it's very rare for a congregation to be wise enough to recognize and discern this because, brothers and sisters, I did grow up in a church that did know a thing or two about being a school of prophets. Reedwood, over the years, has known differently. And there is no doubt we have paid the price for it. But my friends, it may be a dangerous road to be a prophet. It can be an equally challenging idea to propose to be a school for prophets. A congregation that takes quite seriously the possibility that some among them may be struggling with the holy fire. Now, I'm sorry to have to tell you, I don't have a whole lot of wisdom to offer you about this. And I suspect that many of you have at least as much wisdom on this as I ever will have. But let me offer a few thoughts before we enter into open worship together. First, my brothers and sisters, I am not at all sure that prophecy ought to be encouraged as if it is some kind of honor, as if it is some kind of office to aspire to. I have not the slightest interest in advertising ourselves as a school for prophets. Second, this is because I don't think that is the way to respond to the holy fire. I think the way we learn to respond is not so different than our constant dedication to be loving and supporting to just plain old everyday bad behavior. We live in the hope that by loving and listening, we may be nurturing, and sometimes nurturing a fire. A fire by which we may one day find ourselves warming to profound wisdom from God.